Hey there, and you are listening to a cool classroom project we call Forgot Tonya. Now, in our last episode, we spoke with Forgot Tonya native Dr. Trenton Ellis about job loss throughout Forgot Tonya and all of rural America. Dr. Ellis mentioned factors like technology, globalization, and the lack of economic diversity contributing to job loss. And since our talk with Dr. Ellis was so rich in material and we didn't want to depress you by only discussing problems, we split our discussion in two parts. So in this second edition, we address plans of action and we ask two essential questions today. What can we do about factors impacting job loss? And what interferes with progress in rural America? While Dr. Ellis admits there's no quick fix, the wisdom he offers comes not just from his academic background, but his personal experience growing up in rural America. So yeah, we're gonna get just a little personal with Dr. Ellis and more on this edition of Forgot Tonya. Oh. With me today, her name is Tiffany Siepert. She is a recent graduate of Cuba High School. Hello, Ms. Tiffany. How are you doing today?
I'm pretty good. My name's Tiffany. Yeah, I like to sleep and cuddle with animals, and that's about it.
That's awesome. Thank you, Tiffany. Thanks for being here. And so today, we're going to conclude our talk with the awesome Dr. Ellis as he shares his feelings about rural America in the 21st century. One theme of our talk is how huge a role education plays. Growing up in a working class family, Dr. Ellis shares how key relationships helped him get to where he is today. So can I ask you, Tiffany, what's a memorable lesson you had from a parent or a teacher?
I think a pretty memorable lesson is I was doing this painting in art class, and man, it just wasn't working. I just wanted to give up, and my art teacher was like, you just can't give up on life, so you just got to keep painting. So still working
just,
on it.
Just don't give up on life. I love it. I think my memorable lesson is my mama always told me when I was growing up that the world does not go out of its way to make you happy. And that always stayed with me. So, okay, let's go. I'm talking too much. Let's get to the show. In an article titled Beware Social Nostalgia, historian Stephanie Koontz mentions that during the Civil War, doctors actually diagnosed 5,000 cases of nostalgia in Union soldiers. They claim that 74 men actually died from this. Their remedy was to order bands not to play the song Home Sweet Home and ministers not to preach about home. Now today we aren't as intolerant when someone longs for things to return how they once were. But Koontz advises us not to view the past in one dimension. Nostalgia, she says, can distort our understanding of the world in dangerous ways, making us needlessly negative about our current situation.
Like Koontz, Dr. Ellis finds that while nostalgia is not without its benefits, it can cloud our vision of the future. Is our community more enthusiastic about our past than we are about investing in the future? A tangible form of investing in this future is investing in education, in particular higher education. So, how can we increase our efforts to help students from working class families pursue and sustain efforts to complete a college degree?
And what about all the people stuck in the difficult transition between an industrial and post-industrial economy? Like the factory worker, let's say the factory worker who has 20 years of experience, but then the factory suddenly shuts down. How can we invest in the education of someone in this situation? Maybe this person is in their 40s or their 50s and suddenly without work.
You know, I understand we want to look to the past for cues for success. And I'm not saying that that's totally invalid or from my perception that it's completely, you know, that's the complete wrong thing to do, like the past is irrelevant or something.
Right.
But I do think that my hope is that we're not, and because we're rural people, right, and myself included, we love tradition. I love going to like threshers days and stuff. Yeah. I love like if I happen to be in a town in South Dakota when there's some kind of street dance or something that's pretty exciting to me.
Yeah.
So like, I'm there also. I value tradition. But because sometimes I think we are so strongly connected to our traditions and to the past, and that this is so important to us, that I hope that we aren't like that sometimes to our downfall, right? I hope that we don't let that kind of cloud our vision of the future, right? And the other kinds of possibilities, because there may be a lot more that a community has to offer, and it's going to be hard, it's going to be, require, like you said, all these different groups of folks coming together, like a variety of different organizations, and a lot of work, but I think that we have to look at the reality of this 21st century world, and I think that's going to be not just better for maybe rural people, but I think that's better, it's really better for everybody, because if we want our country to be competitive, if we want companies in this internationalized economy where companies are transnational now, like Caterpillar, if we want them to be in the United States, not just even within Peoria, if we want them to stay in the U.S., we want to have a high quality workforce, right, that's competitive, that has the skills and knowledge that this 21st century economy demands. And so I get worried that if our focus is so much on the past that we're not maybe concentrating on those investments for the future, because in Illinois right now, unfortunately, higher ed is, I mean, people across the board, but higher ed is really struggling. And I mean, that's a complex thing, and there's a variety of different arguments that have made about how to streamline higher ed or maybe make it more efficient or whatever. Regardless, we have to, especially for working class people, because they have less access.
Yeah.
Right? I was a first generation college student. It was, when I compare my situation to my wife, and I know these are only two people, right? But you can do this at a level of social groups, right? We can look at different social classes and examine their probability of attending higher ed and their future earnings and all these other things.
Yeah.
But when we look at my wife's situation and my situation, both my parents went to high school graduates. My wife's parents both have graduate degrees. And her experience, even just in the college application process, versus my experience, was very different.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't know, FAFSA was a difficult thing for me to figure out. Yeah. Like, I had to sort all that out. And I'm not saying, woe is me. Here's the world's tiniest violin playing a sad song for my story or whatever. But I'm saying that makes a difference, right? So we have to invest in places like Spoon and higher education. And okay, I'm biased. I'm a college professor, obviously. But I think that those kinds of opportunities can only help people who are struggling. The folks who are going to struggle more than the folks who already have parents that attended college. And folks who are going to struggle disproportionately are going to be the sons and daughters of folks in working class families, and even those parents themselves, right? Because we don't want to forget that, I have students in my classrooms that are going into their second career because they worked in a factory or something and it closed down or whatever happened.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I want to make that clear that not just for our kids that are in high school or whatever, but even for their parents, that's where I look, and when I think about investing our society's valuable resources, right?
Yeah.
Where are our tax dollars going, and where can they be effective, and how can they help people, especially those who will disproportionately and have disproportionately suffered in face of some of these changes? And I think it's in training. It's in making things like trade adjustment assistance, which is basically if your job gets outsourced, right? That the government has certain programs that you can enroll in and learn how to become a heating and cooling technician or something like that, or learn, you they give you money to go back to school to retrain, right, so that you can use these new skills and then get back into a rewarding career. But there's difficulty with that program isn't perfect, right? And the other thing is when somebody's been working in a factory until they're 50 years old and they get laid off because they got replaced by a robot, or they got replaced by a robot in Mexico or somewhere like that. That's a difficult situation.
Yeah.
Because, this is somebody who has a history, and now you're asking them to learn something new and do something different.
It's nearly impossible to discuss this topic without getting a little personal. All of us from Fort Gautonia are connected to someone experiencing the day in and day out blue collar sweat equity that we spoke of last time. But what about children of those in working class growing up in Fort Gautonia? Do we encourage them to pursue traditional careers within the community, or do we encourage them to invest in more white collar skills typically gained from years of in higher education? And when this happens, do we suddenly abandon our beloved blue collar values, which parents and grandparents worked so hard to instill?
Man, you're full of some great and challenging questions. And the truth is, we're not likely to find one story that fits this entire experience. Yet if we tried to find a story like this, Trent Ellis's experience isn't a bad place to start. Dr. Ellis is the son of working class parents who made a multitude of personal sacrifices. They believed it was their duty to pass on values like working hard and building things on your own. Key mentors with professors at WIU helped him find a home away from home. This and more helped Trent Ellis get to where he is today. So what can young people who are growing up in Fort Gautonia learn from his story?
Like, first of all, I also want to say, though, that, you know, I had food in my refrigerator, right? My parents were there for me, like, if I really needed something, like, you know, my father, for example, he worked a lot, and he still works a lot and worked very hard, and my mother, you know, she was always there to make sure that we had, you know, dinner was ready, that we were getting to our practices, or, you know, that, you know, to an extent that we were getting our homework and stuff like that done, even if she didn't, you know, have the expertise or whatever to help us. Sometimes she was like taking me to a tutor, right, to help me. So I want to say that I'm very fortunate. I'm very lucky. Also, just seeing how my parents struggled, right? Seeing like the, when I talk about like the food on the table, that wasn't just like, it was like I saw that my dad was working like a lot, and so, and I, and not just them. Like I see that I saw some of the hardships, right, that some of my family went through. That, you know, and I'm not saying that educated folks don't go through hardship either, don't have difficulty. You know, we saw in 2008, for example, during the housing crisis and whatnot, there, it, you know, it almost didn't matter who you were or what degree you had. If you weren't, you were impacted in some way. Most people were. And so, you know, I'm not saying that you get your degree and you're good to go. You don't ever have to, you know, everything's good for you. Like, it's still a struggle, you know, it's still, it's, there's still hardship. But I was pretty advantaged, I think, and I had grandparents and extended family who were there for me, you know, when I really needed them. And I also I think I personally experienced that tension. I still do. I find myself preferring sometimes to work on my house, or I just recently insulated and put up walls on the inside of my garage. I find myself sometimes, I didn't grow up being really good at school. Like, I wasn't like, and I, when I say grow up, I mean like even through my undergrad, like it was a struggle. Because I always, like, work to me was always, I always associated work with like doing something with my hands, like making something, like building. Because I, it was always easier for me to see the immediate product, right? It was always like, I
could
do this.
Point,
Until I got to graduate school, and then work, school became work, right? School was my job. I was lucky, and I would thank whoever's listening, if you know any folks at Western Illinois University. Those folks gave me a tremendous opportunity in an assistantship to work and go to school at WIU for my master's, in my master's program. So there were folks out there who like really kind of stuck their neck out for me.
That's great. That's
there's
great.
Probably, I can't imagine what that conversation was like of whether or not we should let this guy in and we should, you know, give him an assistantship.
Right.
There, I hope, I think there are probably some folks there who maybe had to do some convincing. of their colleagues. But so cool. I'm really lucky. But I think that there's probably that tension, I would imagine, among a lot of kids. Like that grow up in working class households. I mean, I don't know. I don't know. I can't. As a sociologist, I shouldn't generalize based on my own experience. I think that I've seen it, you know, and other folks too, that it's, it just, you're in school and you don't know, like, you don't really connect this with the end game, right, or with the end product. It's hard sometimes too. When you're in school and you're learning about, you know, the Underground Railroad. So like when you're learning about those things, like I think sometimes, especially maybe for working class kids, I don't know. But for me anyway, it was difficult for me to be like, you know, oh, I'm learning about this and it's gonna really mean something one day for me. I mean, I knew education was important. My parents, my father, you know, my society, my culture, right? My high school teachers. People stressed the importance of education, but it wasn't reified like or real in like a lot of my family. But I could see eventually there's a point where I could see kind of the differences. Like I started, you know, I did have some friends whose parents went to school or whatever, and I could see some of the examples of the outcomes, right? Mm-hmm. I could see my parents and how they struggled and whatnot. And again, I'm saying I was pretty advantaged, and I could see the difference between that and maybe other folks, like in other people's families, right? And so it's hard, though. I think it's, for an educator, I think one of the things is, how do you translate this stuff for people who maybe it's not a part of their everyday life at home, right? Yeah. That their parents aren't, like, you know, talking to them about the Underground Railroad, or I'm saying this because there's a poster.
There's a poster right there.
Or talking to them about... Yeah. The Nuremberg trials, free trade agreements, or whatever it is. these are things that, like, that I'm really excited, you know, when my kid, I'm having a kid eventually, by the way, in August, you know, I'm really excited to, like, engage him with, and like, oh, what'd you learn at school? Well, in some households, though, like, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing. I'm not, definitely, some households are engaged in other things. I know a lot about hunting and fishing and that kind of stuff, because for culturally, that was, like, a big part of, like, my upbringing and stuff. I'm not saying, like, I didn't, and how to change my own oil and how to, you know, work on things, and that I can change my brake pads. Like, that's not something I necessarily have to pay someone to do, right?
Right, yeah.
I'm not saying that those things aren't valuable, because there have been a heck of a lot of times where there's something that's broken in our house, and because I understand basic mechanics and plumbing or whatever, that I can, like, do that, right? I'm not saying that stuff's not valuable, kids. That's really valuable. But... as I told a student once, when she was talking about, like, how rural people, you know, we really know how to do things and how to survive and all this other stuff. And I was like, and I said something like, I know how to clean, I know how to kill, clean, and cook a squirrel, but it's my education that's put my food on the table.
Oh, that's
right?
A good point.
I love that. Education puts food on the table. That comment actually subconsciously made me literally want to put food on this table.
Calm down, please. Okay, so we know higher education is important, and investing in higher education is crucial to developing 21st century skills valued in today's workplace. But Ellis reminds us that education is much bigger than gaining job skills. As a sociologist, Dr. Ellis sees how schooling is just one piece of the pie that makes a healthy community. And when we connect the dots, we see how important these networks are.
Yes, and one of Dr. Ellis's favorite concepts in sociology is the idea of social capital, a concept which I'll let him explain further, demonstrates the power of schools in particular as a source of cohesion for most rural communities. In fact, one of the first references to social capital was a 1916 article by L.J. Hanifin about the importance of investing where else? But in rural schools. The community as a whole, says Hanifin, will benefit by the cooperation of all its parts. If we want to address solutions, we first have to change the way we see our communities. We have to connect the dots.
You know, I think that's a challenge for, like, educators, is that's one of the challenges. And then you have these other problems, right? Education isn't just, like, coming to school and learning about stuff.
Right.
It's also our kids eating. Right?
Yeah.
You know, if you can't, if you, the only meal you get at school is maybe your breakfast, if your school has breakfast, or your lunch, maybe you're thinking about lunchtime. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're thinking about, it's Friday, what am I going to eat over the weekend?
Right, yeah.
What am I going to go to grandma's house, or where am I going to, what's my strategy, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe mom and dad, unfortunately, maybe there's some other issues involved, alcoholism, you know, other types of substance abuse disorders, and then that gets I mean, as a sociologist, I kind of see things networked like this. So when I'm looking at education, I'm seeing those situations, and then I'm seeing the services available in the community, mm-hmm. right, for those kids' parents. Mm-hmm. Like, those services that are available for those kids' parents are a part of their education.
Right.
Right. We don't often right. think about, we don't have that's that, a lot of us, you know, we don't have those that relational or networked way of thinking, but, you know, domestic violence prevention, you know, a law enforcement agency or local law enforcement that work effectively with domestic violence, you know, prevention or substance abuse mm-hmm. prevention or whatever, like this network of human and social services, these are all very much a part of education.
Right. Right?
Yeah. And unfortunately, yes, sometimes kids' parents aren't there for them. And we can say, you know, we can say, well, if the parents would do this, or if the parents, they just, you know, what they need is better parents. Well, they don't have it. So as a community, I think we have to decide, are we willing to be there for those kids?
Yeah.
Right? And that's difficult because, you know, those are your resources. You've worked hard, right? You've worked hard to get that house and have this car and to, you know, pay your mortgage every month and your car payment and all these other things you have to pay for. But at the same time, it's like, that issue is connected to you, you know, in some way. Like that issue, that's not just kids out there.
Yeah.
You know, these are people in your community. You're either gonna pay for it, like on the front end, or, you know, there's gonna be some other, that kid's going to have a higher chance of suffering from the same issues, right?
Yeah.
And now you're paying for it through your law enforcement or, you know, paying for them in substance abuse programs or whatever. So.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, and that's hard because, you know, I hear this narrative a lot with, like, well, it's the parenting. And yes, absolutely. But what do we do about that?
Right.
You know, do we just say, well, it's just too bad. The kid's gonna, you know, and it's too bad and whatever. And, or do we, like, figure out, like, how to create? And I think that's where rural areas, I think they have an advantage because they have these more highly embedded social networks. Mm-hmm. And what I mean by that mm-hmm. is that I don't just know you, I know Sue,
right,
who knows you, who knows me. So somebody I see at the grocery store isn't just Cindy the cashier. She's also goes to school with my kid,
right,
or her dad coaches my kid's softball team, or you know what I mean?
Yeah,
we know people in a variety of ways, right?
Yeah.
So we have sometimes information, sometimes people know about things about me in this town before. So I think that that's an advantage that's a type, and what we call that in sociology or even economics as well, we use this term, social capital. This investment, so human capital is the skills and knowledge people have, right? Social capital is the relationships people have.
Right, right.
And there's bridging social capital, which is that happens between different groups of people, and that could be people of higher socioeconomic statuses, or, you know, people who have higher incomes and whatnot. And between those folks and people who have lower incomes, it could be between folks of different races or ethnicities, right? But bridging social capital is this idea, and it could be with, you know, between the community as a whole and another community. Right.
Yeah,
it's just this idea that you're connecting folks from, you know, different backgrounds or folks who have differ from one another in some important way.
Yeah.
Like this group differs from this group in some important way.
There's
bonding social capital, which is what happens within groups, right? This is homogenous relationships between people who are similar to one another. And that could be, you know, relationships between all the Catholic churches in town, right? Or all the, I don't know, evangelical churches in town, or something like that. And then bridging social capital would be across denominations, or maybe across faith, right? Interfaith groups and stuff. So that's an area where I think rural people can, I mean, I'm not saying that metro people can't, they don't have embedded networks too, or whatever, mm-hmm. within neighborhoods, right? They don't have these enclaves of, it's kind of like a mini rural community within an urban community. But rural places tend to be these places where we have these, like, informal networks of information and, you know, did you hear about so-and-so's dad?
Yeah.
You know, like,
yeah.
this is a, It's not something that somebody had to read in the paper.
Yeah.
Right? It's they know about it because so-and-so told them, who heard about it from. It's because we know each other, you know, even if we don't know each other. You and I didn't really know each other before this, right?
Yeah.
Even if we don't know each other, we kind of know each other because we know the same people. So I think there's some advantages to that, right? Like, and values. Like, you have, I mean, rural places are a little different now. I mean, they are a little more heterogeneous. There are more differences within maybe rural communities now than they used to be. And but you still have maybe, I don't know, and this is where I get into, this maybe not necessarily pans out in the research or whatever, but I feel like being a rural person, that you have more of, you have like this collective consciousness, right? Sometimes that's, you know, this way of norms, values, and beliefs that are very strongly shared. Sometimes it's a good thing, you know. Sometimes that can be a little exclusive, right? People who think differently or who look differently, who wear different hair, who do have different kinds of relationships or whatever, that's different, so it's bad. So sometimes that can be exclusive, but I think that, you know, what I know from living here, from living in this area most of my life, is that this is a community that somebody's house burns down, somebody's got cancer, somebody dies and couldn't afford, you know, the funeral arrangements, or you know, this is a community where people, even if they don't know you, they're going to come to your benefit.
Absolutely,
right? They're going to come to your walk or to your motorcycle ride, right? That's a big thing. That people are going to come together in some way, shape, or form to help. And I think that's not anything that's, you know, I think sometimes people think that's something that's been lost, but I don't think it's been lost.
Every time
I come back here, you know, informally, right? I didn't study this or anything, so maybe I'm wrong. But I see something going on. You know, I see like somebody's having a benefit for so-and-so that passed away or whatever. That's the first thing, is like, I think like with education, is seeing education, seeing what education actually is. And I don't think it's just, I learned this, here's an exam, did you know it, did you not
exactly,
know it?
Exactly, yeah, exactly.
It's also food insecurity. It's also, you know, issues of domestic violence, and also talking about stuff like that.
Yeah.
It's embarrassing maybe.
Yeah.
But you know what? Like, if we don't, like, talk about it and, you know, try to work through it, and otherwise it's just, you know, kind of going to be the same or whatever. Yeah. And I'm not saying, like, oh man, like, in Spearfish, I'm on this, you know, commission or whatever to end domestic violence, and I'm also part of this group, and I'm also part of that group, and this group, and that group. You know, I'm definitely not as involved as maybe some of my colleagues, or especially folks who have been there for a while.
Yeah.
And I think that that's something I need to think about, right?
Yeah.
Like, even myself included, like, that. You know, how do I get involved? What can I do? How can I be of help to people when they might need help?
According to a recent poll conducted by the Washington Post Kaiser Family Foundation on rural and small town America, despite differences on a number of issues, the vast majority of rural Americans judge their communities favorably as a place where people look out for each other. And because we look out for one another is the reason many choose to stay in Fort Gautonia, working through these problems. How many benefits, for instance, have you seen the past month for a person, family, or organization in need? We all step up and take care of each other.
Yes, indeed. But although our small towns can have the coolest benefits and fundraisers for people and organizations, the need for government policy is essential. According to Dr. Ellis, the role of government is to ensure the well-being of its citizens, and services for the most vulnerable is a fundamental role. Benefits are great, but because we can only have so many, policy is better.
Uh-oh, did you say policy, Mr. Brewer? That sounds a little too much like politics, which is something else Dr. Ellis mentioned. To truly achieve the type of society Dr. Ellis and so many others desire, we must strive to understand others' perspectives, how to deliberate and talk to one another, and how to avoid those trigger words when we're trying to have a difficult conversation.
It's not just that, it's also translating that into actual policy, and I think that requires, some people may shudder when I say it, that requires government. sustained, formal organizations. Because a benefit helps out here and there, you know, that stuff works. It does help out. But when it comes down to it, having people dedicated who are always there, who are, and also having evidence-based policies, I think is important. Having policies that are supported, acted consistently, effectively, that's what government does. Because it's not, a lot of this stuff's not necessarily profitable. We can't expect the market to take care of some of these. So that's where governments come in. And I don't know, I think that there are a lot of folks who have a negative view of that sort of thing, maybe sometimes justified because of how they've seen mismanagement or corruption or whatever it is. But just because those things exist doesn't mean that we, you know, just because the plumbing's wrong, something's wrong with the plumbing in my house doesn't mean I set the house on fire.
Right.
You know, I fix the plumbing, right? I fix it. Yeah. I retool it. Yeah. And then make it a reflection of how I would hope or how those organizations should act, right, or should be, not just, let's get rid of it. I don't know. I mean, like, that's one thing I don't want is, like, to come off as, like, these are the answers and this is the solution to be done because I am in my third year in my appointment right now.
Yeah.
And this was my third year at BH, and there are a lot of people out there who are a hell of a lot smarter than me. I'm also, you know, I'm part of this community, but I'm also kind of not, right? I'm also an outsider. I don't want to, like, come off as, like, this is what I would do, or this is what... So, you know, part of this conversation for me is about, like, how I see, like... And I mean, all the stuff that I'm saying, you could look it up and read about it and stuff as well, but so part of this is my perspective of just, you know, some of the major changes that have been happening and the challenges that those have created for rural places.
Yeah.
I mean, that comes from... I mean, that's based in literature, right? It's based. But as far as, like, what people can do, I mean, I don't know. Like, framing is a big issue. Like, how you frame initiatives, how you frame arguments, how you frame a narrative, right?
Yeah,
a narrative,
yeah,
which is like a story, basically.
Yeah.
One good thing that I think you all have going for you is I'm not saying this in a mischievous, like, the way that this sounds bad, but it's the reality. That framing this through the lens of faith, religion, that's huge.
Yeah.
It touches people. Even if you know, folks aren't going to church every Sunday, or maybe any Sundays, there are quite a lot of folks in the area, and I don't, from a variety of different faith backgrounds, and there's a lot of commonalities, I think, between different faith backgrounds.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of folks who that speaks to them on a very deep level.
Yeah.
And so beginning with that can be beneficial, right? Like, I think that's a good way to get support, right? And I don't want to be exclusive either, though. I don't want to, like, you know, there are folks who they're maybe agnostic or atheist, or that, you know, they probably volunteer, I don't know, at the local food bank or whatever.
Oh,
you know,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Like, so, I mean, I'm not saying we have to be exclusive, but I think that in places like this, that faith is something that connects with people.
Yeah.
Framing some of these problems and the solutions from that context, or using the narratives, right, the stories that come from different faith traditions, those kinds of things can help, you know, scripture. And I know, like, people, like, funny, because, like, you'll see somebody quote scripture and somebody else will quote the opposite thing, right?
They're, yeah.
Like,
completely yeah.
Like, but.
It's a whole mess, yeah.
They also said this.
Yeah.
But I think that, in general, like, there are a lot of folks, you know, in rural communities tend to have higher religiosity, meaning that they have higher levels of faith, right? Mm-hmm. Higher levels of belief.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean that people necessarily go to church more,
mm-hmm.
or more often. Whatever, it just means that, you know, they have maybe deeper belief in rural areas in general. But I think, like, that's important. I think respecting, like, tradition and respecting, like, I think people also have to understand the perspective of the other. Like, meaning that if I'm talking to someone who has different views on the criminal justice system, if I'm talking to somebody about minimum mandatory sentencing laws or something like that, I have no idea like, I don't know anything about their perspective or their, how they see, you know, mandatory, say they're for minimum mandatories and I'm against them. And I think that, you know, we need to change laws or something that, that I think they do more harm than good or whatever. I probably know my perspective and maybe know a little bit about why I don't think what they think. But I think we have to do more to understand the perspective sometimes. I mean, that involves, like, listening to radio, even if it, like, you hear it and it's just like, wow, like, I can't believe they think like that,
sure,
right? Regardless of your political perspective, it's on the right or left or whatever. So I think that, and I also think that, like, people don't realize, like, how much, like, they actually have in common. We seem to be politically polarized or more polarized than ever or whatever. Like, most of us want the same things, right? We want, like, a community that's safe. So we want, like, our kids to grow up in a community that's safe. We want them to have access to opportunity. Upward social mobility, usually, is what we're talking about, or at least to be comfortable, you know, financially, economically, all that. And most of us, we want that. It's just that a lot of times we disagree on how to get there. So I think we have to, like, think about, like, the perspective, like, people's perspectives, try to understand. Yeah. When I went, so not that long ago, I lectured in Slovenia for did a couple lectures, and one of them was on rural America and the election of Donald Trump. And, like, after Trump was elected, like, there were many people who were, like, surprised. Like, you're like, oh my God, you know, maybe including some folks who supported Donald Trump. But for me, like, part of me, like, I wasn't really all that surprised.
Right.
Like, because I understood the things that he was saying and how they appealed and why they appealed to a lot of the people who voted for them or voted for him.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was speaking directly to people from communities like mine, right?
Yeah.
Or communities that I come from. And so I understood, like, he's paying attention to these really important issues. And so a lot of these students in this class that I was lecturing to, they were all from all over the world. They were from different places. None of them were from Slovenia, which was interesting. But they all, like, were, like trying to understand, like, how could this happen? Like, you know, it doesn't seem like somebody that would be elected in the. And so I kind of lay it out there, and like, oh, okay, like, we totally get it.
Yeah.
We may not necessarily, you know, those students maybe didn't necessarily agree with him and his election and all this stuff, but they understood, like, how it happened. And so it wasn't, I think that it's sometimes if we really, like, work to know, like, how other people are seeing the world, then we can empathize. Not saying that we have to agree, but empathy necessarily means that we think that their perspectives are legitimate or valid or whatever, but we have to understand where they're coming from in order to, and this, again, this sounds devious, right? But this is communication, right? This is, in order to understand how we can create a narrative that appeals to those folks.
Yeah.
Right? And this is why there's things in political science like opposition research, right? And
stuff. Oh.
It's the truth, I think. It's that's why these things, this is a real thing that you have to know how other people that see the world differently than you, how they see the world, especially if you're trying to create solutions and be inclusive, right? Not alienate folk. Because you use certain language, they're gone,
Absolutely.
Right? Or they hear, I saw this video online of this, I think she's a Republican representative, and she's talking about, like, she's very, like, believes in green energy, and climate change and some of these other things. And she's a, like, evangelical, like, Christian, like, she considers herself to be incredibly conservative on a number of things. But on this issue, she says that, you know, she is less to the right, that means. But says she's less, is different among her colleagues on this issue, the issue of the environment. And what she starts talking about is that a lot of times people are, when they start a conversation, they're talking about global warming. Right, they're talking about green energy and all these other things, and she says, you know, for many people, their light switch turns off. They automatically they're now erecting a fence, or a wall, to basically they're defensive. And what she says is, like, but you start discussing these things in terms of energy freedom, energy independence, decreased dependence on foreign oil, like some of these things, like energy freedom, the freedom to create an energy infrastructure in a variety of different ways, right? Energy choice or something is what she talks about too.
Yeah.
Like, the people shouldn't have to just choose, that they could have a diverse you know, especially maybe geographically, depending on where they live or whatever, that they deserve to have energy choice, right? Energy freedom. And that this is a very much a capitalistic component of our capitalistic system. Competition is important. Why? Well, it leads to innovation, right? Innovation, theoretically, leads to a higher quality of life for the consumer, right? Or cheaper goods and services and that kind of stuff. So she's, like, placing this kind of left-wing policies kind of this left-wing interest or whatever in, and she also discusses religion as well, creation care, right, some of these other things, and she places this issue completely within the, she puts it within a narrative that sounds, sounds, it is based on conservative principle, well, or quote-unquote, you can't see me doing the air quotes, but quote-unquote conservative principles, because I believe in the free market. I think that they're, you know, capitalism has been a good thing and some of these other things too. But but I don't necessarily consider myself to be a quote unquote conservative. Conservative on some things. And I think that's the most way most people realistically are.
Yeah.
Even if we do say that we adhere to one tribe or the other. But you know, the way she frames this, I'm just like, I've been paying attention to, you know, listening to environmental podcasts, and, you know, all this other stuff for a number of years. I try to use my own grocery bags and try not to drive if I don't have to. I never heard somebody talk about green energy or environmentalism in that from that frame, right? Using that frame, these different frames that form this narrative that was very much a conservative narrative, but it was all using these different frameworks, religion and freedom and all these other things to discuss. And that for her, that wasn't just like she was using this stuff to convince people that this is what they should do. She really believes this.
Yeah.
This is like her thing. Like she, this is where she stands out in her opinion and where she really believes these things. So it's genuine. It's not just trying to sell somebody snake oil and figure out how you can. I don't know if you like know anything about South Dakota, but it's like politically, it's like, it's very conservative. Like, and it has been for quite a long time.
Sure.
The first issue I talk about in my social problems class is climate change. And that becomes like, that becomes kind of like the beginning thing that we end up, like, we start with climate change, and then that we branch out and talk about crime and poverty and some of those other things. But the very first, like, I discuss this social problems process, or how social problems become like social problems, how it moves from something that exists out there in the world to something of concern among a lot of people, and then perhaps even into policy. Well, the first thing we do is we look at climate change, and that's a big one. Like, there are a lot of people that, well, that's a liberal idea. So, yeah, it's, I can't imagine. I'm using this example, but it's totally different because I'm talking to students, right? But talking to people in the community, that's a different thing.
It is,
there are other adults, other people. Language is, it's funny. Like, I mean, but it's important. It's like how we how we make sense of our world, right? How we see the world and think about it through language.
Yeah.
And that's why, like, I think, like, framing and thinking about narratives and those kinds of things are so important, because you can either connect with, use a frame to connect, or you could start somewhere else and completely. A lot of things get, government programs, things get labeled like a socialism, right? Like, that's socialism. That's, and it becomes challenging then, because that first impression. One thing that's helped me is like this capitalist framework that I like often, like, I basically like teach. I teach a rural American communities in the 21st century class.
And that'd be a great class.
That class is based predominantly on this community capitals framework, which is just like the idea that a community has stocks of different kinds of capitals, right? Maybe in some areas you have difficulties or challenges, but maybe there are some other things that are going well. So I think like that, and that's a community development, right? It's a tool both for, it's a perspective. So it's a way to like look at a community and like think about its resources and stuff and relationships between them. But it's also something that can actually be applied in order to develop those kinds of capitals. So you can measure human capital. You can measure social capital. People do the Christian, or do the Protestant, does a Protestant community communicate with the Catholic community? Either of these communities, you know, communicate with the Muslim community. You can measure that. You can ask. You can find out. Yeah. You can measure human capital, right? Yeah. You can look up that data. You can probably on the census website. You can look at demographics of the community, like, and understand, like, how many young people we have. Are the young people coming back? That you can actually, like, it's not just a perspective. It's also, a methodological type tool, meaning a way to, methodology is just, what do you do to know what you know? right? It's like a framework. So what you can do is, you know, measure these things in surveys or using, like what you all are doing
that's
right now,
idea,
getting together with panels or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think that's a kind of a cool way to approach communities, because especially communities that are disadvantaged in terms of resources, because you're basically one of the beginning things, depending on the challenge you're dealing with, you're kind of initially just kind of taking stock, figuring out like, what is the issue, doing like a needs assessment.
Wow, great thoughts from Dr. Ellis. And if you want to learn more or have any questions for Dr. Trent Ellis, reach out to us on social media and we will get your questions to him. Or you can just enroll in Black Hills State University in the awesome city of Spearfish, South Dakota. Hey, so Tiffany, what was your favorite part today?
I like how Dr. Ellis warns us not to let nostalgia cloud our vision of future.
My favorite quote from this was, "I know how to kill, clean, and cook a squirrel, but it's my education that puts food on the table." I like that. I appreciated Dr. Ellis's comments. Certainly not intended to devalue one's ability to hunt squirrel, because that certainly does come in handy, but that it's important more than ever to invest in education.
I also learned that small towns have a huge advantage when it comes to social cohesion, because everybody knows everybody. It's a lot easier to work together, connecting all these dots that contribute to our education.
And I learned in my favorite part, I have a lot of favorite parts, okay, was Dr. Ellis's call for everyone to try to understand the perspective of others. If you love someone, you will seek to understand them. So to close this thing, many rural Americans may not feel the most optimistic about the future, but perhaps there's more reason to hope than they think. In fact, a writer named Michael Elliott actually named the last 10 years the sparkling decade. He says it's a time of innovation and optimism, pushing toward a renewed future based on the twin forces of technological advancement and globalization. Sounds a lot like something Dr. Ellis might say. Although we are facing many difficult challenges, if you change your vantage point, things look less like a decline and more like a rebirth. Thanks for listening.